associate pastor of a church in Florida. From there, they zigzagged across the South, having three children with no two born in the same place, and finally got assigned to Clanton a few months before Pearl Harbor. Jackie loved Clanton until the day Dexter died. But not long after the funeral, she realized she couldn't stay. The most immediate reason was that the church wanted the parsonage. A new minister would be assigned, and his family would need a place to live. The church hierarchy generously offered to provide housing for a year at no cost, but she declined. Another reason, indeed the most significant one, was that the children were suffering. They adored their father and could not accept his absence. And in such a small town, they would be forever stigmatized as the kids whose father was gunned down under mysterious circumstances. To protect them, Jackie moved to a place they knew only as the home of their grandparents. Once in Rome, and once the children returned to the ritual of school, she realized how temporary the arrangements were. Her parents' home was modest and certainly not large enough for three children. She collected $10,000 in life insurance and began looking for a place to rent. Much to the concern of her parents, she began skipping church. They were devout Methodists who never missed a Sunday. Indeed, few people in their part of the world missed church, and those who did were talked about. Jackie was not in the mood to do much explaining, but she made it clear to her parents that she was struggling with her faith and needed time to re-examine her beliefs. Privately, she was asking the obvious question. Her husband, a devout servant and follower of Christ, was reading his Bible and preparing his sermon at church when he was murdered. Why couldn't God protect him of all people? Upon deeper reflection, this often led to the more troubling question, one she never asked aloud. Is there really a God? The mere consideration of this as a passing thought frightened her, but she could not deny its existence. Before long, she was being talked about, according to her mother, but she didn't care. Her suffering was at a level far above anything a few local gossips could inflict. Her kids were struggling in a new school. Day-to-day living was a challenge. 2 weeks after moving in with her parents, she moved out and into a rental home on the other side of town. It was owned by a lawyer named Errol McLeish, a 39-year-old bachelor she had known years earlier at Rome High School. McLeish and Dexter had been in the same class, though in different circles. Like everyone in the small town, McLeish knew the story behind Dexter's demise and wanted to help his young widow. After weeks of barely eating enough to sustain herself, Jackie had finally lost the pounds she had gained 6 years earlier with her last pregnancy. It was not a weight loss scheme she would recommend to anyone, and it was, so far, the only bright spot in an otherwise hideous nightmare. But she had to admit, as she looked at herself in the mirror, that she was skinnier than she had been in years. Now, at 38, she weighed the same as on her wedding day, and she admired her newly uncovered hip bones. Her eyes were puffy and red from all that weeping, and she vowed to finally stop it. McLeish stopped by twice a week to check on things, and Jackie began using a bit of makeup and wearing tighter dresses when he was around. She felt guilty at first, with Dexter still warm in the ground, but she wasn't even flirting yet. She had no plans to pursue a romance for the remainder of her life, she told herself. But then, educated bachelors were probably scarce in Rome. She was, after all, now single, and what was wrong with looking nice? For his part, McLeish thought her cute but with serious baggage. The widowhood was one thing, and something that could be dealt with over time, but he wanted no part of a ready-made family. As an only child who had spent little time around children, he found the idea overwhelming. He led her along, though, quietly taking advantage of her pain and loneliness, and the noticing advanced to flirting. His real interest was in her possible lawsuit. McLeish owned several properties, all heavily mortgaged, and he had debts from other deals, and after lawyering for 10 years, he realized it was not going to be that profitable. As soon as Jackie moved back to Rome, McLeish began setting his traps. He traveled to Clanton and snooped around the courthouse long enough to learn about the Bannings. He spent hours digging through the land records, and when confronted with the inevitable inquiry, he claimed to be a leasing agent for a big oil and gas company. As he expected, this rippled through the courthouse and around the square and through the law offices, and before long, Clanton was seized by its first and only oil rush. Lawyers and their assistants pored over dusty old plat books while keeping a sharp ear for gossip and a close eye on this stranger. McLeish, though, soon vanished as quietly as he had arrived, leaving the town to wonder when the oil boom was coming. He was back in Georgia, where he checked on the widow Bell with a polite regularity, never appearing eager or interested, but always thoughtful, almost deferential, as though he understood her tangled world and wanted no part of it. In 1946, Hollins had an enrollment of 375 students, all female. The college was 100 years old and had a sterling reputation, especially among upper-class Southern ladies. Stella Banning chose it because many of her mother's well-to-do friends in Memphis went there. Liza did not, primarily because her family couldn't afford it. The girls wrapped themselves around Stella like a tight cocoon and shielded her from intrusions and negativity. They found it hard to believe that someone as pretty and sweet as Stella could be in the midst of such a tragic family drama, but it certainly wasn't her fault. No one at Hollins had ever been to Clanton. A few knew her father was a war hero, but to most girls that mattered little. No one had met her parents, though her brother Joel had made quite a splash during a recent visit for alumni weekend. In the days and weeks after the killing, Stella was never alone. Her two roommates stayed with her during the nights, when she often awoke with nightmares and bursts of emotion. During the days, she was surrounded by friends who kept her busy. Her professors understood her fragility, and she was allowed to miss class and postpone homework and papers. Counselors checked on her daily. The president monitored her situation and was briefed by a provost twice a week. It was soon known that she would not be going home for the Thanksgiving holiday. Her father had ordered her to stay away. This prompted a flood of invitations, some from friends and professors, some from girls she hardly knew. Stella was touched almost to tears and thanked them all, then left Roanoke on the train with Ginger Reed, perhaps her best friend, and headed to Alexandria, Virginia, for a week of partying in D.C. She had been once before with Ginger, and she was enthralled by the big city. Though she had not told her parents nor Joel, she planned to graduate as soon as possible and follow the bright lights. New York was her first choice, D.C. her second. New Orleans was a distant third. Long before the killing, she knew she would never again live in Ford County. After the killing, she wanted to stay as far away from the place as possible. Though her dreams had been interrupted, she was still determined to become a writer. She adored the short fiction of Eudora Welty and the bizarre and colorful characters of Carson McCullers. Both were strong Southern women writing in authentic voices about families, conflicts, soil, and the tortured history of the South, and they were successfully publishing in a time when men dominated American fiction. Stella read them all, men and women, and she was convinced there was room for her. She might start with stories about her own family, she often thought to herself, now more than before, but knew that would not happen. She would land a job with a magazine in New York and live in a cheap apartment in Brooklyn with friends, and she would begin her first novel as soon as she settled in and inspiration hit. She was reasonably certain that her parents and her Aunt Florrie would support her if necessary. Being a Banning, she had been raised with the unspoken belief that the land would always remain in the family and provide support. Enjoy life in New York, work for a magazine, start a novel, and do it all with the knowledge that there was money back home. The dream was exciting, and it was real, until the murder. Now home was far away, and nothing was certain. Ginger's family lived in Old Town, in an 18th century mansion on Duke Street. Her parents and younger sister had been briefed on the details of the Banning family nightmare, and it was never mentioned. Stella was treated to a week of cocktail parties, long dinners, walks along the Potomac, and a string of clubs frequented by students where they smoked cigarettes, drank too much, listened to swing bands, and danced through the night. On Thanksgiving Day, she called Aunt Florrie, and for 10 minutes they talked as if there was nothing out of order. Joel was a guest of a fraternity brother's family in Kentucky, and Florrie reported that he was hunting nonstop and enjoying the break. They would be together for Christmas, she promised. Later in the afternoon, Florrie loaded up a small tub containing 2 roasted turkeys with potatoes, carrots, beets, and turnips, along with a pan of dressing, giblet gravy, yeast rolls, and 2 pecan pies. She drove the feast to the jail, where she supervised the carving of the turkeys by her brother. The meal was for all prisoners and for Mr. Tick Poley, the ancient part-time jailhouse guard who worked nights and most holidays, so Nix and his men could take the day off. Florrie and Pete dined alone in Nix's office, with his unlocked gun case in plain view. An unsecured door opened to the gravel lot. Tick was content to eat by himself in the jail's lobby as he guarded the front door. Pete took a few bites, then lit a cigarette. In spite of his sister's efforts, he was still eating little and looked thin, and because he never went outside, his skin was pale. As usual, she had commented on this. As usual, he ignored her. He did manage to perk up when she replayed the calls from Stella and Joel. In Florrie's version, they were doing quite well and enjoying the season. Pete smiled as he smoked, his eyes drifting to the ceiling and beyond. Chapter 10. By Thanksgiving, the cotton had been picked for the 3rd and final time, and Pete was pleased with the harvest. He watched the markets and reviewed the books each week when Buford came to the jail. He signed checks, paid bills, reviewed deposits and accounts, and directed the selling of his cotton through the Memphis Exchange. He ordered the reopening of the colored school on his property and approved pay raises for the teachers and the installation of new stoves for winter heat. Buford was itching to buy the latest model John Deere tractor. Many of the larger farmers now owned them, but Pete said not now, maybe later. Facing such an uncertain future, he was reluctant to spend a lot of money. The price of cotton was also being watched closely by Errol MacLeish. Georgia produced almost as much cotton as Mississippi, so he was no stranger to its economics. As the spot price on the Memphis Cotton Exchange rose, so did his commitment to the welfare of Jackie Bell. After weeks of discussion and research, John Wilbanks and his brother Russell finally decided the trial of Pete Banning should not take place in Clanton. They would seek a change of venue and try to have it moved somewhere far away. Initially, they had been encouraged by the courthouse rumors that Miles Truitt came close to a mutiny with his grand jury. Evidently, their client had some friends and admirers who were sympathetic, and the vote to indict barely passed. Only rumors, of course, and since grand jury proceedings were not recorded in any fashion and supposedly confidential, they could not be sure about what really happened. With time, though, they grew skeptical about the impartiality of a trial jury. They and their employees talked to countless friends around the county in an effort to judge public sentiment. They consulted a few of the other lawyers in town and two retired judges and a handful of former deputies and a couple of old sheriffs. Since the jury would consist of white men only, and virtually all would claim membership in a church, they chatted with preachers they knew, men from all denominations. Their wives talked to other wives at other churches and at garden clubs and bridge clubs, and almost anywhere the conversation could be initiated without being awkward. It became clear, at least to John Wilbanks, that sentiment was running strongly against his client. Time and again, he and his staff and his friends heard folks say something to the effect of, "Whatever conflict those two had, it could have been settled without bloodshed." And the fact that Pete Banning was saying nothing to defend himself made it even easier to convict him. He would always be a legendary war hero, but no one had the right to kill without a good reason. Under John's guidance, his firm conducted thorough research of every venue change case in American law, and he wrote a masterful 50-page brief supporting his request. The endeavor took hours and hours, and eventually led to a heated discussion between John and Russell regarding the pressing matter of their fees. Since Pete's arrest, John had been reluctant to broach the matter. Now, though, it was inevitable. Also eating up the clock was the not insignificant matter of mounting a defense. Pete had not minced words when John mentioned a claim of insanity, but there was nothing else to argue before the jury. Obviously, a perfectly normal human who shoots another three times at point-blank range cannot be in possession of his full mental faculties. But to build such a case required the defense to inform the court with a notice and a brief. John wrote one, along with supporting case law, and was prepared to file it at the same time he filed a motion for a change of venue. Before doing so, however, he needed his client's approval. He haggled with Nix Gridley until he got his way, and late one afternoon, a week before Christmas, Nix and Roy Lester left the jail with Pete Banning and drove him to the square. If he enjoyed his first breath of fresh air, he did not show it. He did not take in the festive decorations on the storefronts, did not seem at all interested in what the town was doing, did not even seem appreciative that he was being allowed to meet his lawyer in his office as opposed to the jail. He sat low in the rear seat, wearing a hat and bound by handcuffs, and stared at his feet during the brief ride. Nix parked behind the Wilbanks building, and no one saw Pete enter, with a cop at each elbow. Inside, the handcuffs were removed, and he followed John Wilbanks to his office upstairs. Wilbanks' secretary served Nix and Roy black coffee with a pastry in the downstairs foyer. Russell sat in one chair, John the other, with Pete on a leather sofa across a coffee table. They attempted small talk, but it was awkward. How do you chat about the weather and the holidays with a man who's sitting in jail accused of murder?
How are things at the jail? John asked.
Fine, Pete said stone-faced. I've seen worse.
I hear you're pretty much running things over there.
A slight grin, nothing more. Nick's made me a trustee, so I'm not always confined. Russell smiled and said,
I hear the prisoners are getting fat thanks to Florey.
The food has improved, Pete said as he reached for a cigarette.
John and Russell exchanged glances. Russell got busy lighting his own cigarette, leaving John alone with the unpleasant business. He cleared his throat and said,
Yes. Well, look, Pete, we've never had a conversation about attorney's fees. Our firm is putting in a lot of hours. The trial is 3 weeks away, and between now and then we'll work on little else. We need to get paid, Pete.
Pete shrugged and asked, Have you ever sent me a bill that didn't get paid?
No. But then you've never been charged with murder.
How much are you talking about?
We need $5,000, Pete, and that's on the low side.
He filled his lungs, exhaled a cloud, looked at the ceiling.
I'd hate to see the high side.
Why is it so expensive? Russell decided to enter the ring.
Hours, Pete. Hours and hours. Time is all we have to sell, and we're not making money here. Your family's been with this firm forever. We're old friends, and we are here to protect you. But we have office expenses and bills to pay, too.
Pete flicked his ashes into a tray and took a quick puff. He wasn't angry or surprised. His expressions conveyed nothing. Finally, he said,
Okay, I'll see what I can do.
Well, what you can do is write us a damn check, John wanted to say, but let it go.
The issue had been addressed, and Pete would not forget it. They would discuss it later. Russell reached for some papers and said,
We have some stuff for you to read, Pete. They're preliminary motions for your trial, and before we file them, you need to read them and sign off.
Pete took the papers and, after glancing at them, said,
There's a lot of stuff here. Why don't you just summarize, preferably in layman's terms?
John smiled and nodded and took the lead.
Sure, Pete. The first motion is a request to the court to change the venue of the trial, move it somewhere else, as far away as possible. We've come to believe that public sentiment is fairly strong against you, and we know it will be difficult to find sympathetic jurors.
Where do you want the trial?
The judge has complete discretion in that matter, according to the case law. Knowing Judge Oswalt, he'll want to retain control over the trial without having to travel too far. So if he grants our motion, which, by the way, Pete, is a long shot on a good day, he'll probably keep it somewhere in this judicial district. We'll argue to the contrary, but frankly, any place will be better than here.
And why do you believe that?
Because Dexter Bell was a popular preacher with a large congregation, and there are 8 other Methodist churches in this county. In numbers, it's the 2nd largest denomination behind the Baptists, which present another problem. Baptists and Methodists are first cousins, Pete, and they often stick together on tough issues. Politics, whiskey, school boards. You can always count on those 2 clans to march to the same drum.
I know that, but I'm a Methodist too.
Right. And you have some supporters, old friends and such. But most people view you as a cold-blooded murderer. I'm not sure you realize that. The people in this county think of Pete Banning as a war hero who, for reasons known only to himself, walked into the church and murdered an unarmed preacher. Russell added for emphasis, Pete, you don't have a dog's chance in hell. Pete shrugged, as if that was okay with him. He did what he had to do. Damn the consequences. He took a long drag as smoke swirled around the room. What makes you think things will be different in another county? John asked, Do you know the preachers at the Methodist churches in Polk, Tyler, or Milburn counties? Of course not. Those counties are right next door, yet we know very few folks who live there. They will know neither you nor Dexter Bell personally. Russell said, We're trying to avoid the personal relationships, Pete. I'm sure a lot of those folks have read the newspapers, but they've never met you or Dexter Bell. Without the personal knowledge, we stand a better chance of getting by the raw feelings and planting doubt. Doubt? Tell me about this doubt, Pete said, gently surprised. We'll get to that in a minute. John said, Do you agree that we need to ask for a change of venue? No. If I have to do it, I want my trial to be right here. Oh, you have to, Pete. The only way to avoid a trial is to plead guilty. Are you asking me to plead guilty? No. Good. Because I'm not. And I will not ask for a change of venue. This is my home, always has been, same for my ancestors. And if the people of Ford County want to convict me, then it'll happen across the street in the courthouse. John and Russell looked at each other in frustration. Pete laid the papers on the coffee table without having read the first word. He lit another cigarette, casually crossed his legs, as if he had all the time in the world, and looked at John as if to say, What's next? John took his copy of the brief and dropped it loudly on the coffee table. Well, there goes a month of fine legal research and writing. Pete replied, And I guess I'm supposed to pay for that. If you'd asked me up front, I could have saved you all that work. No wonder your fees are so high. John seethed as Russell fumed and Pete puffed away. After a pause, Pete continued, Look, boys, I don't mind paying legal fees, especially since I'm in a jam like this. But $5,000? I mean, I farm almost 1,000 acres that require backbreaking work for 8 months by 30 field hands. And if I'm lucky and the weather cooperates, and the spot price stays high, and the fertilizer works, and the boll weevil stay away, and enough labor shows up to pick, then every 3 or 4 years I get a decent crop, and maybe I'll clear, after all bills, $20,000. Half goes to Flory. That leaves me with 10. And you want half of that. Your numbers are low, John said without hesitation. His family raised more cotton than the Bannings. Our cousin had a very good crop, and so did you. Russell said, If you object to our fees, Pete, you can always hire someone else. There are other lawyers in town. We're just doing our best to protect you. Come on, boys, Pete said. You've always taken care of me and my family. I have no gripe with what you want. But it may take some time to round up the money. Both John and Russell strongly suspected that Pete could write the check with ease, but he was, after all, a farmer, and as a breed, they enjoyed squeezing a nickel. And the lawyers were sympathetic, too.
because in all likelihood, he would never farm again, and would either die soon in the electric chair or much later in some awful prison hospital. His future was worse than bleak, and they couldn't blame him for trying to save all the money possible. A secretary tapped on the door and entered with an elegant coffee service. She filled 3 porcelain cups and offered cream and sugar. Pete deliberately mixed his blend, took a sip, and stubbed out a cigarette. When she was gone, John said, "Okay, moving right along. We have another motion we need to discuss. Our only possible defense is one based on temporary insanity. If you're found not guilty, and that's highly unlikely, it will be because we can convince the jury that you were not thinking rationally when you pulled the trigger. I've already told you that I don't want that. And I heard you, Pete. But it's not just about what you want. It's more of what's available to us at trial. Insanity is all we have, period. Take away insanity, and all we can do is sit in the courtroom and listen like spectators while the prosecutor strings you up. Is that what you want?" Pete shrugged as if he didn't care and said, "Do what you gotta do, but I will not pretend to be insane." Russell said, "We found a psychiatrist in Memphis who's willing to examine you and testify on your behalf at trial. He's well known and is effective in these situations." "Well, he must be a first-class kook if he'll say I'm crazy," Pete said with a smile, as if somewhat humorous. Neither lawyer returned the smile. John sipped his coffee while Russell lit another cigarette. The air was not only thick with smoke, but heavy with tension. The lawyers were doing their best, but their client didn't seem to appreciate either their work or his own predicament. John cleared his throat again and shifted his weight. "So, to recap where we are, Pete, we have no defense, no excuses, no explanation for what happened, and no chance of moving the trial to a less hostile environment. And you're okay with all this?" Pete shrugged and said nothing. John began pinching his forehead as if in pain. A full moment passed without a sound. Finally, Russell said, "There is one other matter, Pete. Something you should be aware of. We've done some digging into Dexter Bell's background and found a matter of interest. 8 years ago, when he was pastoring a church in a small town in Louisiana, there was a problem. The church had a young secretary, 20 years old and newly married, and there appears to have been some type of relationship between the girl and her pastor. Lots of rumors and not many facts, but Bell was soon reassigned. The secretary and her husband moved to Texas." John added, "Obviously, we haven't dug that deep, and it may be impossible to prove anything of value. It appears as though the matter was kept under tight wraps."
"Can that come into court here?" Pete asked.
"Not without some additional evidence. Do you want us to pursue it?"
"No, not on my behalf. It's not to be mentioned in my trial."
"May I ask why not, Pete?"
John asked with a frown.
"You're giving us absolutely nothing to work with here." Russell rolled his eyes again and seemed ready to leave the room.
"I said no," Pete repeated, "and don't bring it up again."
Proof that Dexter Bell was a philanderer would likely be excluded at trial, but it would certainly help explain the motive for his murder. If he had a wandering eye, and if it caught the attention of Liza Banning when she was mourning the loss of her husband, then the great mystery would be solved. But it was now apparent that Pete had no interest in solving it. He would take his secrets to his grave. John said,
"Well, Pete, it's going to be a very short trial. We have no defense,
no witnesses to call, nothing to argue in front of the jury. We should be in and out in a day or so. If that long, Russell said.
So be it, Pete said.
Chapter 11. 3 days before Christmas, Joel stepped onto a train at Union Station in downtown Nashville, and waiting for him in a dining car was his lovely and fashionable sister. Stella was now 19, only 18 months younger than her brother, but during the past semester, she had grown from a late-blooming teenager into a beautiful young woman. She seemed taller, and her skinny figure had developed some pleasant curves which he couldn't help but notice. She looked older, fuller, and wiser. And when she lit a cigarette, she reminded Joel of an actress straight from the big screen. "When did you start smoking?" he asked. The train was rolling out of the city and heading south. They were at a dining table with cups of coffee in front of them. Waiters hustled about, taking lunch orders.
"I've been sneaking since I was 16, she said. "Same as you. At college, most girls come out into the open when they turn 20, though it's still frowned upon. I was gonna quit, and then Pete got trigger happy. Now I'm smoking more than ever to settle my nerves."
"You should quit."
"What about you?"
"I need to quit, too."
"It's great to see you, sis.
Let's not begin our little trip talking about Pete."
"Begin? I've been on this train for 6 hours. We left Roanoke at 5 this morning."
They ordered lunch and iced tea and talked for an hour about college life, courses, favorite professors, friends, plans for the future, and the challenge of going about their days as if things were normal while having both parents locked away. When they caught themselves dwelling on family, they immediately changed the subject and talked about the upcoming year. Joel had been accepted to law school at Vanderbilt, but wanted a change of scenery. He had also been accepted at Ole Miss, but that was only an hour from Clanton, and given the circumstances, seemed far too close to home. Stella was halfway through her sophomore year and eager to move on. She loved Hollins, but longed for the anonymity of a big city. At college, everyone knew her and now knew about her father. She wanted strangers in her life, people who didn't know or care where she was from. On the romantic front, there wasn't much activity. Over the Thanksgiving break, she had met a boy in D.C., and they had gone dancing twice and to the movies once. He was a student at Georgetown, had a nice family and all, appeared to be well-groomed and mannered, and he was writing her letters, but there was really no spark. She'd string him along for another month or so, then break his heart. Joel reported even more tepid progress. A few dates here and there, but none worth talking about. He claimed he really wasn't in the market, what with 3 years of law school on the horizon. He had always vowed to remain single until his 30th birthday. Try as they might, they could not stay off the most obvious subject. Joel told her for the first time that their father had transferred his land to them as joint owners 3 weeks before the killing. Pete might have thought he was clever, but it was a really stupid move. The prosecution would use the deed as evidence that he was carefully planning his crime and taking steps to protect his property. Joel was spending time in the law school library, and the more he researched, the bleaker the future looked. According to a friend whose father was a lawyer, there was an excellent chance that Jackie Bell would sue Pete Banning in a wrongful death action. This had driven Joel to spend hours researching lawsuits. He was also digging into the unpleasant subject of fraudulent transfers. The deed from their father to them could be attacked by lawyers working for the Bells. the law was uniform throughout the country that a person facing civil damages could not hide or move property around to dodge valid claims. However, Joel had faith in the Wilbanks firm, not only for its legal muscle, but also for its political finesse. He could tell Stella was alarmed by the thought of losing their land. She had already been consumed with the horror of losing her father. She had no idea what would happen to her mother. And now this? The possibility of losing everything? At one point, her eyes watered and she fought back tears. Joel managed to soothe things somewhat by explaining that any potential lawsuit could always be settled on favorable terms. Besides, they had far more urgent matters. Their father would be put on trial in 2 weeks, and pursuant to his commands, his children would not be allowed anywhere near the courthouse. When they finished lunch, they moved to a private cabin and closed the door. They were in Mississippi now, stopping at towns like Corinth and Ripley. Stella nodded off and slept for an hour. They were going home because their father had finally summoned them. By letter, he had outlined the parameters of their Christmas visit. Home on December 22nd, no more than 3 nights in the house, stay away from downtown, don't even think about going to church, limit contact with friends, do not discuss family business with anyone, spend time with Flory, and he would arrange some private time with them, but not much. Flory had written too, as always, and promised some plans of her own, with a big surprise in the works. She was waiting at the station in Clanton when they arrived at dusk. In the spirit of the season, she was garbed in a bright green dress that flowed around her much like a tent designed to conceal her girth. It fell in ripples to her ankles and shimmered in the dim platform lights. On her head was a red fedora that only a circus clown would contemplate, and around her neck was an assemblage of gaudy trinkets that rattled when she moved. When she saw Stella, she bellowed and burst forward, practically tackling her with a bear hug. Joel glanced around during the assault, and by the time Flory grabbed him, her eyes were moist. Stella was crying. The three embraced as other passengers hurried by. The kids were home. The family was sinking. They clutched each other for support. What in God's name had Pete done to them? Joel carried the luggage as the women walked arm in arm, both talking excitedly at the same time. They crawled into the rear seat of Flory's 1939 Lincoln, still talking, with Flory braking long enough to tell Joel he was driving. And that was fine with him. He had ridden with his aunt enough to know the dangers. He punched the gas, and they sped away from Clanton, exceeding every posted limit. As they roared down Highway 18 with no traffic in sight, Flory informed them that they would be staying with her in the Pink Cottage and not in their home. The Pink Cottage was covered with Christmas decorations, warmed by a roaring fire, and smelled of Marietta's cooking. Their home was practically deserted, cold and dark and without spirit, and not a sign of the season anywhere. And besides, Nineveh was depressed and did nothing but mope around the house, talking to herself and crying, at least according to Marietta. When Joel turned into their drive, the talking stopped as they approached the only home he and Stella had ever known. It was indeed dark, lifeless, as if the people who had lived there were all dead and the place had been abandoned. He stopped the car with its lights shining in the front windows. He turned off the ignition, and for a moment nothing was said. "Let's not go in," Flory mumbled. Joel said, "One year ago, we were all there, all together for Christmas.
Dad was home from the war. Mom was happy and beautiful and buzzing around the house, so excited to have her family together. Remember the dinner we had on Christmas Eve? Stella said softly, Yes, the house was packed with guests, including Dexter and Jackie Bell. What the hell has happened to us? Because there was no answer, no one tried to offer one. Pete's truck was parked next to the house, and next to it was the family's sedan, a Pontiac bought before the war. The vehicles were where they were supposed to be, as if those who owned them were inside the house and tucking in for the night, as if all was well around the Banning home. Flory said, Okay, enough of this. We'll not spend our time wallowing in misery. Start the car and let's go. Marietta has a pot of chili on the stove and she's baking a caramel fudge pie. Joel backed away from the house and followed a gravel road that swung wide around the barns and sheds of the Banning compound. They passed the small white house where Nineveh and Amos had lived for decades. A light was on, and Mac, Pete's dog, watched them from the front porch. How's Nineveh? Stella asked. Cranky as always, Flory said. Her feuds with Pete's housekeeper had been settled years earlier when both women decided to simply ignore each other. Actually, she's worried, same as everybody else. No one knows what's in the future. Who's not worried? Stella mumbled aloud. They were moving slowly along a dark stretch of road with endless fields around them. Joel suddenly stopped and turned off the ignition and the lights. Without turning around, he said, Okay, Aunt Flory, here we are in the middle of nowhere with no one to eavesdrop on our conversation, just the three of us, alone and together for the first time. You always know more than anyone else, so let's have it. Why did Pete kill Dexter Bell? There must be a good reason, and you know it. She didn't respond for a long time, and the longer she waited, the more Stella and Joel anticipated her words. Finally, she would reveal the great mystery and make sense of the insanity. Instead, she said, As God is my witness, I don't know. I just don't know, and I'm not sure we'll ever understand it. Your father is perfectly capable of taking his secrets to his grave. Was Dad angry with Dexter? Any kind of disagreement or feud over a church matter? Not to my knowledge. Did they have business dealings of any kind? I know it's a ridiculous question, but stick with me, okay? I'm trying to eliminate possible conflicts. Flory said, Dexter was a preacher. I'm not aware of any business dealings. So that brings us to the obvious, doesn't it? Our mother was the only connection between Dad and Dexter Bell. I remember those first days when we thought he was dead. The house was crawling with people. So many people that I had to get out and go for long walks around the farm. And I remember Dexter came over a lot to sit with Mom. They would pray and read the Bible, and sometimes I sat with them. It was horrible, and we were all in shock, but I remember Dexter as being calm and reassuring. Don't you, Stella? Oh, yes. He was wonderful. He was there all the time. His wife came with him occasionally, but she was never that comforting. After the initial shock of it all, the crowds thinned out, and we sort of got back into our routines. Flory said, The country was at war. Men were dying everywhere. We managed to move on, still hopeful, still praying a lot, but we got about our business. Goodness, we had to keep living. The question is, how long did Dexter hang around, Flory? Joel asked. That's what I want to know. I have no idea, Joel. and I'm not sure I appreciate your tone. It's accusatory. And I've done nothing wrong, nor am I hiding anything.
We just want answers, he said.
And maybe there are none. Life is full of mysteries, and we're not guaranteed the answers. I was never suspicious of anything between Dexter Bell and your mother. In fact, the mere suggestion is shocking to me. I've never heard a peep from Marietta or Nineveh or anyone for that matter, not the slightest hint that things were going on.
There was a long pause as Florrie caught her breath. Stella said,
Please, start the car, Joel. I'm getting cold.
He made no move toward the ignition. Florrie said,
At the same time, I have always kept my distance from Liza, and certainly from Nineveh. I can't imagine Pete living in the same house with both of those women, but then that was never any of my business.
To which Joel wanted to reply something along the lines that the house was actually quite pleasant before the war anyway, back when life was normal. And Stella thought, though she would never say, that it had always seemed to be Aunt Florrie who caused trouble in the family. But then, too, it had been before the war, back when both of her parents were more or less in one piece. Joel pinched the bridge of his nose and said, I'm not accusing my mother of anything, you understand? I certainly have no proof, but the circumstances demand these questions. Stella said, You sound like such a lawyer. Florrie snapped,
Good heavens, Joel. It's 30 degrees outside and I'm freezing. Let's go.
At noon on Christmas Eve, as Nineveh was buzzing around their kitchen preparing at least 5 dishes at once, and Joel and Stella were trying their best to pester her and make her laugh, the phone rang. Joel grabbed it first and said hello to Nix Gridley. The call was expected. When he hung up, he informed Stella that their father would be home in about an hour. Then he left to fetch Aunt Florrie. 10 weeks in jail would weather any man, but Pete Banning seemed to be aging faster than most. His hair was grayer, and the wrinkles were spreading at the corners of his eyes. In spite of Florrie's takeover of the jailhouse kitchen, he somehow managed to look even thinner. Of course, for some prisoners, 10 weeks meant time closer to freedom. For men like Pete, though, there would be no freedom, thus no hope, no reason to keep the spirit alive. One way or another, he would die as a captive, away from home. For Pete Banning, death had certain advantages. One was physical. He would live the rest of his life in pain, at times severe pain, and that was not a pleasant prospect. One was mental. He would always carry images of indescribable human suffering, and at times these burdens drove him to the brink of madness. Almost every hour, a battle raged as he tried gamely to purge them from his mind. Only rarely was he successful. As Pete looked at the future, he figured this was to be his last Christmas. He convinced Nix of that and finagled a quick visit to the farm. He had not seen his children in months and might not see them for a long time. Nix was sympathetic to a point, but he was also unable to erase the thoughts of the Bell children never seeing their father again. As the weeks dragged on and the trial approached, Nix was even more convinced that sentiments in the county were running strongly against Pete Banning. The hard-won admiration he had enjoyed only the year before had vanished in a matter of seconds. His trial wouldn't take long, either. At any rate, Nix agreed to a brief visit, 1 hour max. No other prisoner was allowed such leniency, and Pete was to tell no one inside the jail where he was going. Dressed in street clothes, he rode in the front seat with Nix, as usual, saying nothing and staring at the empty fields. When they stopped behind his truck, Nix at first insisted on waiting in his car, but Pete would have none of it. The weather was frigid, and there was hot coffee inside. For half an hour, Pete sat at the kitchen table with Joel on one side and Stella and Florrie on the other. Nineveh stood by the stove, drying dishes, and all but taking part in the conversation. Pete was relaxed, delighted to see his children, and asked 100 questions about school and their plans. Sheriff Gridley sat alone in the living room, sipping coffee and flipping through a farmer's magazine with one eye on the clock. It was, after all, Christmas Eve, and he had some shopping to do. Pete and the children moved from the kitchen to his small office, where he closed the door for privacy. He and Stella sat side by side on a small sofa, and Joel pulled a wooden chair close. As he began to talk about his trial, Stella was already fighting tears. He had no defense to offer and expected to be convicted with little effort. The unknown was whether the jury would recommend death or life in prison. Either was okay with him. He had accepted his fate and would face his punishment. Stella cried harder, but Joel had questions. However, Pete cautioned them that the one question they could never ask was why he did it. He had good reasons, but they were between him and Dexter Bell. More than once, he apologized for the shame, embarrassment, and hardship he was causing them, for the irrevocable damage to their good name. He asked for their forgiveness, but they were not ready for that. Until he could make some sense out of what was happening, they could not contemplate mercy. He was their father. Who were they to forgive him? And why forgive when the sinner had yet to come clean with his motives? It was confusing and terribly emotional. And finally, even Pete shed a tear or two. When an hour had passed, Nix knocked on the door and ended the little reunion. Pete followed him to the patrol car for the ride back to jail. For the sake of her children, Jackie Bell took them to church for the Christmas Eve service. They sat with their grandparents, who smiled with pride at the lovely family, minus the father. Jackie sat at the far end of the pew, and two rows behind her sat Errol MacLeish, a rather wayward Methodist himself and occasional attendee of the church. She had mentioned that she was taking the kids to the service, and Errol just happened to drop by too. He was not stalking her at all, just keeping tabs from a distance. She was terribly wounded, and rightfully so, and he was smart enough to respect her mourning. It would pass eventually. After church, Jackie and the kids went to her parents' home for a long Christmas dinner, then stories by the fire. Each child unwrapped a gift, and Jackie took pictures with her Kodak. It was late when they returned to their little duplex. She put them to bed and killed an hour by the tree, sipping hot cocoa, listening to carols on the phonograph, and wrestling with her emotions. Dexter should be there, quietly assembling toys as they shared a special moment. How could she be a widow at the age of 38? And more urgently, how was she supposed to provide for those three precious children sleeping just down the hallway? For at least the past 10 years, she had often doubted if the marriage would last. Dexter loved ladies and had an eye that was always roving. He used his good looks and charisma, as well as his pastoral duties, to manipulate the younger women of his churches. He had never been caught outright, and certainly had never confessed. But he had left a trail of suspicions. Clanton was his fourth church assignment, second as senior pastor, and Jackie had been watching closer than ever. Because she had no hard evidence, she had yet to confront him, but that day would come. Or would it? Would she ever have the courage to blow up the family and drag it through a terrible divorce? She had always